The song is called Appreciate by Paul McCartney. If you've never seen the music video for this song, you should access the AI there that's at your fingertips and check it out on YouTube. The video is set in the future at a time when humans are preserved only as specimens in a museum, and our robot overlords come to the museum to see what we used to look like. It's a pretty cool little video if you haven't checked it out. So in the first hour, we heard from James Barrett making the case that there is a genuine risk from a superior intelligence that could emerge very soon. And then in this hour, we will expand the parameters of the discussion, look at the promise and perils of AI through a different prism. When I say that Dr. Susan Snyder travels in rarefied air, the upper echelons of academia, I'm not exaggerating. She's an associate professor of philosophy, the cognitive science program at the University of Connecticut. Also works with the Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics at Yale, is a fellow at the Center of Theological Inquiry in Princeton, and the focus of her work is the nature of the self. How does that necessarily fit in with the discussion of maybe our potential eradication by an army of Terminator bots? Well, if you want to consider the idea of humans melding with machines, you know, our brains being uploaded into computers so we can achieve immortality, as mentioned by Ray Kurzweil on this program, the so-called singularity, you have to get a handle on what it means to be human. What makes us us? How do we differ from the AI brainiacs that might someday replace us? The ethics of AI, pretty interesting topic, and that's where we're going to jump into right after this on Coast to Coast AM. My next guest, Dr. Susan Snyder, has a pretty cool arena in which she works. She explores issues of the mind, ethics and philosophy of science, metaphysics even. And one of the things we want to ask her about, a project she's working with on NASA to study the idea of intelligent life in the cosmos. Welcome to the program for the first time, Dr. Susan Snyder. Thanks for being here.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me.
You know, so much to talk about with you. As I was reading some of the things you've written in popular periodicals and articles to prepare for the conversation, I was overwhelmed with the idea, not only the scope of what you work on, but also the sheer fun of it. These questions you study, it must be so much fun to ponder and pursue who we are, what makes us human. I mean, it sounds simple, but I'm sure it isn't. It's got to be challenging. Is it as much fun as it seems?
It's really fun. Except the stuff on killer AI, that can actually cause you to not sleep well at night. I actually agree with James Barrett's assessment. I listened to much of the show, and I think that isn't so much fun to think about in the sense that, you know, you're worrying about the future of humanity, and right now AI is being open sourced, and it does, as James suggests, look like vastly smarter than human AI could be developed within the next 50 years, say. And, you know, so that causes me a good deal of concern.
The idea of it open sourced, meaning you don't know who's working on it. You don't know who's trying to put this to work for them or what their ultimate motives are.
Right. The information about how to construct an AI could be publicly available. So recently, OpenAI was created by Elon Musk, who ironically is somebody who had been very concerned about the development of smarter-than-human AI, and that's going to facilitate the development of smarter-than-human AI.
What do you think about how close it is? Do you have any guesses, or is everyone's guess just a little more than throwing a dart at a dartboard?
Yeah, I try not to guess too much, but I mean, I think it does seem like AI has really taken off in the last few years in particular, and because of the quickness of processing speeds, it looks like it could be maybe 20 to 40 years from now that we see human-level AI. And then a lot of people who think about this say, well, once you have human-level AI, you can get beyond human-level or superintelligent AI that's smarter than humans in every domain within a fairly short time period, because you can just get the computer to self-improve. So, you know, it can generate self-improving algorithms, use its intelligence to make future versions of itself, which would be vastly smarter than us.
James had said he is viewed as an alarmist in some circles. What about you? For you to even contemplate this stuff, or do you get a second glance from colleagues?
No, I think people are increasingly sympathetic. I mean, when I started to worry about this stuff, for example, when the first edition of my science fiction and philosophy book came out, people maybe saw me as a bit of a science fiction junkie. And as science fiction started to increasingly become more like science fact, you know, my predictions have started to pan out, which is, you know, not something I'm actually excited about when it comes to super intelligent AI. And I think it's becoming accepted now that, hey, you know, these risks are very real, and AI is not just this technology which, as in the 1970s and 80s, people laughed at. It's very serious. And, you know, with IBM's Watson and with Google's OpenMind, people have begun to acknowledge the successes of AI.
Can you address the general idea we touched on with James about the idea of programming ethics into a computer, the idea of keeping them in the corral? Can we build something into them that would prevent them from running amok?
Yeah. So I think it's precisely this issue which led people to realize that and to discuss the dangers of AI in the media. So when you heard recently people like Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and Bill Gates worrying about AI, it was because they were reading a book by Nick Bostrom called Superintelligence, which became a New York Times bestseller, which was actually on this topic of how you would control the development of AI, making the AI that you develop ethical. And there are a lot of problems with the ethical development of AI. I mean, for one thing, in philosophy, the field of ethics sees a lot of controversies about what ethical principles should be. So that's the first problem. Second problem is that even if people could agree on machine ethics, like principles that a vastly smarter machine should follow, maybe, say, utilitarian principles or Kantian principles, the problem is how you program them in a way that the machine actually follows what we intuitively want, as opposed to just following the wording and messing things up terribly. And, you know, that's sort of scary. And then the other thing is that the machine, if it's truly vastly smarter than us, would be able to overwrite anything that we antecedently programmed in. So it's going to do what it ultimately wants to do. And because it's vastly smarter than us, it's difficult for us to predict the shape of what it will do.
You know, we're going to get into what it means to be human, of course, and one of the instincts that we have is self-preservation. And I don't know if you've taken it this far, but is it inevitable that a super intelligent machine would develop that same kind of a thing? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that self-preservation is likely, although it's not an inevitable goal. I mean, it may be that it has a final goal of something that involves its own destruction as a means to an end. But a lot of final goals that it could have seem compatible with the idea of self-preservation because it should be around to maintain its goals. And if it's developed in a way that's based on us, like if it's reverse engineered from, say, humans, you know, in some way, maybe through uploading or through using principles from cognitive science to describe how the human brain works, then it's likely that it will, in fact, be interested in its own self-preservation because humans are.
You mentioned about uploading, which, of course, goes back to Kurzweil, the idea that he could upload his consciousness or his brain into a computer and live forever. And immortality, of course, is a pretty attractive idea. But you've written extensively about this. I guess the first question would be, is that ever going to be possible, that we could upload our brain into a computer? And how far away might the mechanics of that be?
Yeah. The mechanics of that could be pretty far. I mean, it could be 40, 50, 60, 70 years into the future. I mean, that's difficult to know because it's very complicated. We don't know everything about the brain right now. We know a little bit. But now they've already uploaded a worm. That was through OpenWorm. And they downloaded it onto a Lego robot, and it acted like a worm. And they try to simulate many columns of the human brain, and they've simulated a large part, I believe, of the rat cortex, or part of the cortex for rats. So they're developing it. They're working on it. Oxford University's Future of Humanity Institute released a long report on how to do it. So we're at the beginning stages of it. And I guess the question is whether it will be a way to survive. That, for me, is a different issue than creating a copy of a human brain on a computer.
Yeah, I guess it goes to the heart of who we are, what makes us us. I mean, if we upload our brain into a computer, is that us? And you've written about that. What's your answer?
It is and it isn't. So at best, suppose the technology is very, very precise. It's going to be a copy. And that copy could carry out your earthly tasks. It could even perhaps convince people that it's you if it downloaded into an Android body that was very believable. But would it represent you? Would it be in this sense of, would it be a continuation of your life? Would it be the very same person that you were before you uploaded? And I don't think so. I think it would just be creating a distinct being for a lot of reasons. I mean, it's just, if you think about it, I mean, early attempts at uploading are going to be destructive in the sense that they slice up the human brain, they measure a variety of neural connections, and then they copy it into the computer. So if your brain sliced up, you know, and copied into a computer program, I mean, why believe that that represents the continuation of the very same thing that you were before? I mean, ordinary physical objects don't persist like that, for example. I mean, my coffee cup, if I take it apart and I just write a long program expressing its features, and that's not going to be a continuation of the coffee cup. What it is just a program representing the coffee cup.
I mean, it raises some of the same kind of ethical questions about regular cloning the Dolly the sheep or whatever. I mean, it's identical, but it's not Dolly, I guess. And you could also, if you can do it once, upload Ray into a computer or an Android. You can make a whole bunch of copies.
Oh, exactly. So like Smith in the Matrix. I mean, the Smith program in the Matrix, there were many, many copies of it. It was very menacing. Not that Kurzweil would be a menacing individual, but I guess it depends on who you ask. But, yeah, I mean, that's something that may, in fact, be an advantage of machines over humans, that they can upload and download at will. But I don't think a human can survive in that way. At best, all you would be doing is creating a copy of you, a copy of which may or may not even have conscious experience. That's another issue as well, like whether a machine could feel what it's like to be alive, or, say, to see a sunset, or feel curiosity or pain. That's a completely different issue. Even if you could create an informational duplicate of yourself, would that creature have the ability to feel pain and be a moral agent because it's conscious?
Well, like I said in the introduction, you get paid to ponder some pretty cool stuff. Let's take it even a step further. Since you have used sci-fi as a sort of as a teaching tool and a platform in which to discuss some of these issues, take it a bit further. The idea that we could upload our brains into some intelligent computer or an Android or something, do you see a scenario where an intelligence can exist without a computer, without a human body or Android body, that it takes some other kind of form, some ethereal bodiless form?
Yeah, Kurzweil for years has depicted intriguing scenarios. I mean, you could imagine something that's on the cloud and doesn't regularly have a physical incarnation and goes from place to place by, say, just occupying Android bodies whenever it wants. You know, Kurzweil talked about nanobot swarms making, you know, an appearance for a computer. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think our imagination here is limited, and we're going to be very surprised going into the future. The range of different things that come up. I mean, I had the Oculus Rift at my house the other night, and that was absolutely mind-blowing. And the future is going to be, you know, 100 times more mind-blowing, I'm sure.
Well, that's what I was touched on briefly in the first hour, is I am a little bit of a technophobe and a Luddite in that I am overwhelmed. I mean, even in my, I'm a TV journalist, and our industry has changed so much in the last couple of years. I mean, I'm sure at one point we were far more advanced, or at least it looked like it, than the print industry. But in just a couple of years, we're now so much more than an industry that depends on a cathode ray tube in a box. I mean, it's, we're online, and we're on Twitter, and we're on Facebook. We have multiple platforms, and it changes every day, and we don't need a big boxy camera. We can shoot video from a tiny little phone, and when you look around you, the pace of change, technology everywhere, how cell phones are permanently affixed to our ears, and it is overwhelming, isn't it?
It is, and George, I think this is evidence that we may be approaching a technological singularity, you know, a point at which we may, due to the development of superintelligent AI, no longer be able to follow everything that's happening.
You know, if people could attach a computer to their brains, if they could hook it up right now, they'd do it. I mean, they would, you know, they've already done it to some extent with the cell phones and how they're attached. They would use bionic arms and legs. If it would give them an edge over other humans, they think faster and are smarter in business or whatever pursuit there is, they'd do it. They'd voluntarily become machines right now if they could.
Some of them would, sure. I mean, right now I see a lot of enthusiasm for this, you know, within the media, for example. I think there will be holdouts. There'll be people who have no interest in it and who maybe even have religious or cultural backgrounds which preclude it, such as the Amish. And what we'll see is a range of different kinds of brain enhancements. So, you know, you might run into somebody who says, oh, I just got echolocation, and, you know, run into a different person who has this extraordinary linguistic ability because they travel a lot. There'll be a lot of cognitive differences, perceptual differences from person to person. One worry I have is that there may be social pressures to enhance. So consider schools. You know, if kids are enhanced, then obviously it could make them much smarter and their performance would be much better. So what if it almost becomes a requirement for, you know, a college education or for a certain type of job?
Well, then you've got haves and have-nots. You've got people that would be able to afford being enhanced. You have, in essence, have almost another species.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be a plurality of different kinds of minds, I think, moving into the future. There is one good thing, though, about this, and this connects up with the issue of the development of greater-than-human AI, or what I've been calling superintelligent AI, and that is that as humans become increasingly smarter, it may enable them to follow the computations of a superintelligent AI, and that could help them to keep that AI in line, so to make sure that its behavior is ethical and that we understand what its thought patterns are.
Oh, well, I feel much better, much more relieved now. you know, we've touched on it briefly about ethics being discussed in your circles, the people who are on the cutting edge, who are really pushing the edge of the envelope in developing this technology, whether or not they talk about the ethics of it. We can, but should we? And is there more willingness to consider the big picture questions like that among those folks?
Oh, definitely. There's a lot of concern now, I think in large part due to Bostrom's book. And a lot of computer scientists right now are working on the issue in particular. So new institutes have been cropping up all over the world, you know, like Oxford, Cambridge, MIT, California, I think, has the MIRI, Machine Intelligence Research Institute. And they've been getting a lot of funding due to the increased world attention on the issue. So we can hope that all these intelligent minds will figure out some way to control machine ethics. on the other hand,
I'm going to interrupt you, Susan. We're going to take a break here. Blue Oyster Cult, classic rock song Godzilla, which is an ultimate example of the unexpected consequences of technology, right? Nukes created Godzilla. When we come back, we're going to talk about NASA and intelligent life in the cosmos and other similar topics. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So you're wondering to yourself, what the heck is that? That's Flight of the Conchords, a couple of comedic musicians who are putting a funny spin on a not-so-funny scenario. Name of the song, The Humans Are Dead. You'll have to look that up on YouTube and watch that one for yourself. It's pretty funny. We're talking with Dr. Susan Snyder about some pretty big questions. What makes us us? Can we upload that into machines? Would we even want to? When we come back, we're going to get into some of the work she's doing with NASA, looking for life in the cosmos. Chances are, she thinks, it might be AI if it's out there. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Back to my guest, Dr. Susan Snyder. Susan, how hungry is the general public for this topic, and how hungry are your students? I can imagine you go to a party, you get surrounded, considering the depth and breadth of the kind of things that you study and write about.
It depends on what kind of party. I mean, if it's family, I don't know. But yeah, my students, you know, they love this stuff, and there really is increasing concern for these issues, and it is, for me, a way to get students to think about really deep questions about the nature of reality, you know, what the nature of the self or mind is, and I use science fiction as a way to get into these issues, so I teach a class called Science Fiction and Philosophy, and I love teaching that because I show a little bit of science fiction, and we use it as a springboard for philosophical discussion of various topics.
I can imagine some hard science guys who scoff at the idea that philosophy is a science itself. They would think it's just too soft for them. But it really, when you get into these kind of questions, it really does get down to some philosophical stuff. The nature of consciousness, I guess. In 2014, you wrote something for the New York Times, The Philosophy of Her, after the movie Her came out, about a guy who has a romance with a female artificial intelligence. And you explore the idea of, could an artificial intelligence, a machine, have consciousness or have true feelings? Talk about that for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, so that was a fun piece to write. So I think that philosophy is really important in the context of understanding the self or mind going into the future, precisely because there are limits to what science can explain. So science can tell us, you know, about the information processing ability of an AI, and they can tell us some things about whether the AI has structures in its artificial brain that are like human structures that could maybe give rise to consciousness. But there are some deep philosophical questions that are also involved in making judgments about AI consciousness. So I think that there, for a long time, there have been questions in the field of philosophy of mind about whether something that is made of silicon rather than, you know, a biological carbon-based system could actually have conscious experience, whether it would be the right sort of stuff for consciousness. And while I'm sympathetic with the view that computers in the right circumstances could be conscious, I think it's still an open question. And I call that the hard problem of AI consciousness, how we can ever know that a silicon-based system is really capable of being conscious as opposed to just acting believably to many like it's conscious. So, you know, Samantha and Her is a good example of a system that was very, very intelligent, more intelligent than humans, and which seemed believably conscious. And, of course, there is a question there about whether a system like that, even if it's best friends with the human it's interacting with, truly has an inner mental life.
Yeah, I mean, once it's that smart, that all-seeing and that all-knowing, how would you measure it? What's the test to measure it?
Yeah, that is a very good question. If a system is built based on reverse engineering a human brain, then we can look at it and see that it has structures that are similar to us. You know, so consciousness has been associated with, say, working memory and attention, and there are is a big literature on what those things are. But if you just get a system that has altered itself greatly and is no longer in any way, shape, or form thinking like us, then it's harder, because how would we know what structures in that machine would underwrite conscious experience? You know, all we can do, we can look at the case of animals that are vastly different cognitively and perceptually than humans and ask that question. But it's very, very tricky.
Well, I mean, it gets into areas that some of your science, hard science colleagues would be very uncomfortable with. The idea of a soul, I guess. I mean, consciousness, soul, is there something to it? Do humans have something that other animals don't have? Do we have something that an artificial intelligence could never have? Is it strictly something that only exists in biological organisms? That gets perilously close to religious and spiritual topics that I know a lot of your science colleagues would not want to touch.
Well, you know, I find that the scientists do like to touch these topics when you chat with them. It's just they don't touch them professionally, but a lot of people do care deeply about these subjects. So this year, I'm at the Center of Theological Inquiry, and many of my colleagues have raised this issue. And, you know, I think it's very important that we have these dialogues. And I know of people who've actually argued publicly that machines can have souls. I mean, 10 or so years ago, Anne Forrest, who's actually a minister and a computer scientist, wrote a book arguing that computers could, in principle, have souls. So I think, you know, this is something that increasingly theologians will need to debate. Now, the issues that I've raised, however, are not really issues about souls at all. You know, I'm just pointing out, hey, it's an open question whether an AI has the right stuff to be conscious. And even if we uploaded and became essentially AIs, you know, we were in a program, that creature may or may not even be us. So these are issues that I think are different than the kind of issues that concern the nature of a soul, although I do think that these religious debates are very important as well.
Let me touch on one other one before we get into the NASA discussion that you have written about. I mentioned a couple times The Matrix, the movie The Matrix, and that's one of the chapters in a book that you had, or a paper you had dealt with. The idea that I don't know if you ever get the feeling that we live in some kind of that one day is not as real or doesn't feel as real as the next day, and makes you wonder, I have anyway, whether it really is real, whether it's simulated, whether it's a computer program, some alien teenager with a supercomputer or a quantum computer has made this reality. What's your take on that, or the Matrix scenario?
Yeah, you think they could have made the world a nicer place if that was the case, right?
Not as interesting, I guess, maybe.
We might try to look for glitches in reality, you know. So I actually think that there is a good argument for us being in a computer simulation. It was a paper written by Nick Bostrom, and I teach it in Introduction to Philosophy. My students love it because, in a way, it's related to traditional philosophical issues raised by Plato and Descartes about the nature of reality. And, you know, it's an empirical question that maybe we'll find out one day the answer to. I mean, maybe we'll find out that the universe can't be simulated for some physical reason due to the physics of computing.
There's a guy named David Deutsch. I remember reading his book, The Fabric of Reality, where he talks about quantum computers. And once you pass the threshold and you got real, genuine quantum computers, you could, in essence, create your own universe.
You never know. I mean, quantum computing is under development, as you know, and it's going to make computing much faster if they can, you know, work through some of the problems with it. And I think you never know what the future is going to bring.
Let's talk about NASA.
Okay.
Sounds like a pretty interesting project you're working on there. And I saw one of the titles of one of the papers that you had written talking about the search for life in the cosmos. The suggestion from the title of that paper was that if it's out there, you think it might be AI. Let's take a shot at it.
Yeah. So a number of people who work in the field of astrobiology think that ultimately the most intelligent civilizations, if they exist at all, would be post-biological. So they would have already gone through a singularity. And as you and I just noted, you never know when it comes to computational speed what you can do at that level. So, I mean, the AI out there could be not even detectable by us because we don't even know what to look for. And that's exciting, but it's also, given what we were just talking about, a little unnerving because we don't know the shape of its ethical principles. So we don't really, you know, we can't say that they'll be like us in any significant way. But I doubt they're going to be interested in us. I don't think we're in danger.
So it'd be so far beyond us, we'd be so insignificant. What would be the point? Unless it's for sheer entertainment, you know, we're like the drive-in movie of the universe or something.
Exactly. I mean, as Seth Shostak, who's at the SETI Institute, likes to say, we don't kill our goldfish, but we don't sit around reading books to it.
Well, it makes you wonder, too, if it's AI and it's out there and it doesn't have a body, it's a super being that just floats around like a cloud, it could also be here and just kind of occasionally messes with us.
You never know.
So is NASA, so what's the ultimate aim of what NASA has asked you to work on?
Well, I just was invited to give a talk over at a symposium at the Library of Congress that was sponsored by NASA, and they wanted to know what the shape of alien minds would be like. And so I turned up and I said all this stuff. And this year I'm working on a year-long project exploring different elements of that over in Princeton. And there are two things that I'm interested in. I mean, one is the issue of machine consciousness. Issues about how we would detect it and whether a machine has the right stuff to be conscious. And then the other one is about the development of superintelligent AI. So a lot of people have been working on the correct moral principles to encode into a machine and how you would write such a program. Well, what I'm doing is I'm working on how we would understand the sophisticated computations of a superintelligent AI. And so I'm looking at general properties of computational systems that I think would be present in many superintelligences that we could potentially encounter either on Earth or in outer space.
Well, I would think SETI would be really interested in that too. I mean, you know, they're casting their gaze in different directions and promising planets looking for signs of intelligent life, radio waves or whatever that, you know, might exist for only a short period of time in any given civilization. I guess they would need other parameters with which to conduct their search than the ones they've been using.
Yeah, they discuss this stuff. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of excitement right now about this alien megastructure. You see that sometimes in the news that there's a star 1,500 light years away that Kepler detected had some occlusions in front of it. You know, so that the patterns of light detected, you could see that there was something blocking it, and people were saying, oh, it's a Dyson sphere or a Dyson cluster, which is evidence of an advanced civilization. And then that hypothesis was ruled out, and then just yesterday, some really clever person, I think it was at Penn State, went back and found measurements that dated, like, you know, 50 years into the past, and they said, wait a second, if that was really just, you know, a natural phenomena, why would it have been present for that long and nothing really looks like it can do that naturally? So now the issue is still back in the news again, kind of exciting. But, yes, SETI's very open-minded, and there are discussions of whether advanced alien life would, in fact, be superintelligent AI.
My experience with NASA as a journalist in trying to engage them on topics about alien intelligence is they get pretty nervous and uncomfortable in dealing with it. I mean, they don't want to get anywhere near UFOs, of course, but you know, as long as it's a long way away and it doesn't come here, they're okay talking about it.
Well, I think what they're interested in mostly nowadays is you know, detecting life elsewhere. And you know, people may assume that they mean intelligent civilizations, but no, they're excited about finding, say, microbial life and about a whole range of topics. And I mean, they certainly don't want to be misrepresented in the media when they make comments about finding alien life, that they're talking about finding little green men.
Sure. You mentioned, I remember in one, maybe the New York Times article, you made a mention of something the Department of Defense was working on, trying to develop a computer that sort of resembles the human brain in form and function. I guess in one sense, I'm pleased that the Department of Defense would be on the forefront of this. Maybe it could be, if somebody else develops it, it could be weaponized. On another level, I guess I'm a little worried about what they might ultimately do with that.
Yeah. I advised them recently about machine consciousness, actually. And, you know, I think since it almost everybody's in agreement that the development of artificial general intelligence is going to happen and you can't put an end to it, so a global ban on its development is not in the cards. And with this open sourcing, you know, the information is going to be available to all sorts of people, all sorts of governments. So I think let's just, you know, hope for the best. I mean, you know, let's hope that the Defense Department does the right thing with the technology.
Yeah, because they always do, you know. I mean... I'm being a wise guy.
I'm very concerned, I will say, because I, you know, I went to UC Berkeley and I, you know, I'm a bit of a leftist. And, you know, I felt kind of strange advising DARPA. But, you know, I found them extremely concerned about machine ethics and about safety and very intelligent. And that was heartening.
I'm going to touch on one other thing in the few minutes we have left. Another area that you delve into, space and time. You use movies like 12 Monkeys and Back to the Future and The Time Machine to explore scenarios for time travel. I mean, that also opens up a whole other can of worms in terms of ethics and if we could, should we kind of a thing. Can you touch on that a little bit? Is there a legitimate interest in academic circles about just at least exploring the possibilities there?
Well, yeah, I mean, philosophers actually teach papers on time travel. There's a really vigorous debate about whether time travel is possible. And philosophers have also been keenly interested in the nature of space and time. And right now, within string theory and related areas that focus on issues involving the relation between quantum mechanics and relativity, there's a big debate about the nature of space-time that's very exciting. So the thing I love the most, I think, in terms of teaching issues involving space-time is the time travel stuff, because there, if it's physically possible, like if you really could go back, there are all kinds of paradoxes. Like, could you go back in time and kill an ancestor who created you? Well, if so, I mean, then how could you even exist to go back in time? That's called
right.
The grandfather paradox.
Right. There's answers to that, right?
There are answers. I don't think they're good ones.
You have a new project you're working on, the Singularity Papers. Tell me about that and when that's going to be done, what's going to be in it.
So that's a collection of my essays, and it's going to be a popular book as well as an academic book. So, and it's on topics involving the singularity, so issues that we've talked about today. And, you know, it's going to include some papers I've already written and some new ones, and then have a comprehensive introduction. And the idea is to get more sophisticated philosophical issues on the table involving a variety of topics on the singularity, ranging from mind uploading and other forms of brain enhancement to superintelligent AI.
Well, that sounds fun. You'll have to come back and talk to us again when that comes out.
That would be wonderful, George.
And you need a reality show or something, because it's too much stuff to cover in an hour, that's for sure. Dr. Susan Snyder, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, George.
Thank you. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Kevin Warwick, professor of cybernetics, talks about the future of bots. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.